Access number 14974, Paul Armstrong, Reel 8.
I'll give you some talk about an officer's life.
Mr. Armstrong, Reel 8. The people of Chipping Norton, you said, were very kind. What
yeah.
kind of leisure activities were you yourselves getting into?
Well, apart from the usual visit to the pub, we were billeted in a very large country house owned by a regular officer who was away overseas. He had 6 horses, and he had requested that they be exercised in his absence. So it meant, living in Chipping Norton, that was the centre of several of the larger hunts. And we officers were given the opportunity, in our time off, of using these horses to hunt. Well, my riding ability was limited, and as far as I personally was concerned, could have done perfectly well without it, but the CO insisted that everyone had to take part in one of these hunts, and unfortunately for me, my horse was a very keen hunting horse, and when we set off, he wanted to be right ahead, right in front of everyone if humanly possible. And naturally, eventually, I was thrown and landed, luckily softly, but hard enough to pretend that that was the end of my hunting days. Apart from that, I became very friendly with a gentleman who had a pheasant farm, and he came from Bishop Auckland, where he'd had an hotel. And I was very welcome to go and see him and chat any time I was off duty. One interesting thing happened there. Whilst we were sitting one night, the dogs began to bark, and that meant that there was a fox about. He jumped up, seized one gun, from above the fireplace. I seized the other. We both ran out, and he managed to kill the fox. And we were just talking about this. He said, "What a beautiful pelt. Look at that." And he talked about it at length. And I said, he said, "You're not married, are you?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, would your mother like a fox fur?" And I said, "Well, I suppose she would. I have no idea." He said, "Do you know anyone who could cure it for you?" And I said, "I think so." He said, "Take it with you. You're going on leave, aren't you, in a few days' time?" And I said, "Yes." So he put this fox into a sack, but by merciful providence, he put several pheasants in above it. Because I say merciful providence, because the next day when I was going on leave, as I was about to get into the vehicle that was taking me to the station, the hunt arrived and the hounds went absolutely berserk. And the colonel was really cross with me and said, "What is it? What is it? What are you causing the hounds to bay for?" And I said, "Well," and opened the sack and showed a pheasant wing. And I said, "I suppose it's this game I'm taking home." "Oh," he said, "get the hell out of it." I never knew that the hounds were much more sensible than the masters. That's the sort of thing that was happening to us. When I say people were kindly, they were. not only him, but the we were invited to people's houses. We were given various little presents from them to augment our rations. It was, when you think of the number of troops that descended on these people, literally a small country town, it was wonderful the way they all, almost all, cooperated.
Did you keep your battalion sporting activities going whilst you were there?
Yes, yes.
Did that involve civilian teams as well as army teams?
No. The teams were all from the army, but each platoon had to field a rugby team and a football team. And unfortunately, from our point of view, every officer had to play in his platoon's team. And the opposition naturally took the opportunity of knocking down the officer of the opposite team, part of the tactics. And this went on until one officer had a leg broken, another officer had a collarbone broken, and a third one had his head was kicked and he suffered from concussion. And they decided that this was not quite the kind of game spirit that was expected.
Was this an opportunity for the men to get their own back at an officer?
Could be. We also, the officers also had, most of us had our cars, and we used to drive down to Oxford when we had some spare time. That's from those days. But we were very earnestly training. I must emphasise that.
Were the long days of effort and energy being used?
There were long days in one way, but they were too short in others. There was so much we had to learn. We realised we were just tyros. It was rather pathetic to think how little. And an interesting thing about that was, for a while, they tried a platoon commander, what they call a platoon sergeant major. And we had one who had fought in the First War, and he had a military medal and three bars. And he used to gather his men around him at night and say to them, "Now listen to me. Your job is to kill bloody Germans. You must kill Germans. This is what you do. Never forget, if he's dead, he can't do anything else." And he had his team, his platoon, absolutely imbued with the idea that they must kill as many Germans as possible.
Do you remember his name?
Dear me, I could have told you that yesterday. Crudus, Harry Crudus. There we are. I don't know. It was said in the end that this wasn't a good idea, that they dropped that. Possibly they had sufficient university-trained people to be given commissions and to take over these jobs. But my experience of the regular warrant officers was they were second to none. Absolutely second to none. In fact, on the retreat in France in 40, my sergeant major, I honestly will always feel that he brought us home.
There'd be a lot of men, or a number of men in the unit, who were quite old. Were they being cleaned out or moved?
Ah, yes. This is one thing I should have mentioned. When we were embodied on September 3rd, 1939, I was actually the orderly officer, the duty officer of the day. I'd been called up late in August, as I probably mentioned. And it was rather pitiful to listen to the anguish of some people who'd been married for quite a while before they were called up, and some who had quite a number of children. But I'm pleased to say that all those men during the next 3 to 4 weeks before we went to Chipping Norton, during the time we were over at Whitburn doing our firing course and the rest of it, the men who were over age were sent back home. The men who were obviously not fit enough were sent back home. And in one case, we had a father and a son who joined together, and the son, they were separated, so that there was no likelihood of them being both killed together in one action. So, yes, the army were pretty reasonable that way, and the MO was working every day to make sure that unfit men weren't allowed to proceed through. Val Wardle was a most caring man, as well as being pretty tough. And he was incidentally captured in Singapore and spent some considerable time in a cage.
Was there an upper age limit at that time?
Yes, I can't remember it. From memory, it was about 43, but I cannot say for certain what the upper age limit was.
Conscription would obviously trawl in a lot of highly skilled men.
Later.
Were they sorted out and sent back to their work?
Well, I personally was in a reserved occupation. But, as I think I mentioned, I saw the certainty of war in September 1938. And so I immediately applied to join the Territorial Army, where I knew I would be able to get out of this commitment. All of these sort of people who were called up and shown to be in a reserved occupation were sent back. And in fact, by 1941, we were given an instruction, when I was with the 2nd Battalion, we were given instruction that all miners who wished to return to the mines should be discharged. An interesting thing I must tell you there was I paraded my platoon and asked them if they to step forward, the ex-miners, and no one stepped forward. And I said, now come along, you so-and-sos. I know that. And I pointed to several who I knew were young miners, and they said, I broke ranks and said, right, now gather around while I can talk to you off the record. Why do you not step forward? You know damn fine we're going to Burma, and it won't be very pleasant. You'll find it too hot. And they said, too hot? Those been never down pit. And, of course, I realised that was a stupid remark. However, they also told me that, generally speaking, it was the first holiday they'd ever had, and they weren't going to forego it to go back down to any mine. And I said, well, somebody surely must go back. And the smallest man in the platoon was pushed forward, and they said, he's got, I'm not sure whether it was 4, 5, or 6 children, he'd better gun back. And he was literally pushed out and made the sacrifice to the mines. Interesting.
Can we look now at some of the officers that you were serving with and had known since you came in, but were approaching this stage of the war when you really were getting ready to go to France? What were the personalities of for example, the colonel, what was he like?
had little dealings with the colonel. I must say that I I didn't think he was the sort of colonel that I would hoped to have. And I'd rather leave it at that. The second in command was Lawson, and Jack was obviously too old, and he was sent back and became commandant of the military hospital at Sedgefield. Other officers were brought in. Our company commander was a chap called Cummins. They were stationers in Bishop Auckland and Newby Street. They had a shop. And Ronald Cummins had been in quite a while. And I thought he was a keen, and he did work. He was a hard-working company commander. We had our second in command was the son of Colonel Walton, who commanded the battalion in the First War, and he was young but extremely keen to try and show that he could do come up to his father's expectations. The other platoon commander was Dougie Caldwell, who was brother-in-law of Walton, and who was the third one? I've lost somebody there. But the friends I joined with, people like Maurice Kirby, who served with the 6th Battalion right through the war until the day it was disbanded owing to losses, was how shall I put it, very smart. He, you could reckon, would get through anything. He was that sort of a chap, well able to take care of himself, and in fact he distinguished himself in that he picked up Field Marshal Rommel's camp kit and had it brought home and sat in Rommel's camp chair for the rest of his life. That's the sort of chap Maurice was. Dickie Dennis comes straight from school. His father was a handicapper of racehorsing, and poor Richard was only 17 and a half when he came to us, and he was captured in Italy and escaped from the Germans and lived with the partisans until he was rescued by the army advancing up Italy. The next one was Jasper Rudd. His father had commanded the battalion in the 1418 war. He was a tiny little man. The troops used to say, be careful, Blanco, the underside of your kit today, Mr. Rudd's on duty. But he worked very hard, and he, like myself, had the unfortunate habit of saying the wrong thing at the wrong time. He, incidentally, was posted to the 2nd Battalion, and with the quartermaster, was the only officer on his feet to come back from Dunkirk.
They were in general held in respect by the men.
Oh yes, they realised, as far as the men were concerned, they knew that we worked as hard as they did, that we trained as hard as they did, that we marched as far and further than we did. They knew that we looked after their welfare, and in return they looked after ours. I must say that I found the 6th Battalion a happy battalion, and there was no one that one really felt dislike or anything for. You had people like Michael Ferns, who was commanding B Company, the Barnard Castle Company. Mike was the the flour mill people at Bishop Auckland had been in the town all their lives and a very, very good family. He went eventually to brigade and did various staff jobs. There was Leslie Proud, a solicitor in the town. Leslie married a girl when they were down in the south and never came really back into the north. I used to see him at the club occasionally, but he rarely came back. And his brother was also an officer, not a field commander, but a platoon commander, and he just come from school. You can pick different people out, and all the same, they were keen. They worked as a team, and one felt one could rely on them. And this is what matters.
You've mentioned your general impressions of the warrant officers and the NCOs.
Yeah.
Were there any that stand out in your memory at this stage of the war, these early stages?
In the early stages, well, the RSM was very good, and I still cannot remember his surname. Joe, we always called him Joe, and this is a silly thing. I can picture him. He wasn't a tall, big chap at all, but he was very, very efficient. And our company sergeant major, I always admire. He come from Yorkshire unit. His name was Samuel Shufflebottom. And Sam was a good, old-fashioned, regular sergeant major. And boy, did we need him.
Amongst the men, again, the other ranks, what were your opinion, or what opinion were you forming of those men? Obviously, they were coming in from civilian employments, and here they are about to go off to France.
Well, most of my men were from the Crook area, and they were all, I suppose you might say, from the labouring classes. There were miners and various other jobs amongst them. They were all being volunteers. But during the, to make up for those that were discharged through being unfit, overage, various other complications, we got a number of national servicemen from the King's Shropshire Light Infantry. And they, of course, you remember the first national servicemen were 20-year-old when they were called up, and they tended to be country boys. And it was interesting that our chaps, although the difference between Shropshire and Durham was considerable, took them into their hearts perfectly happily, and they amalgamated very quickly. But apart from two, there were, generally speaking, of quite a good class and quality of chap, and they made very good soldiers. The two I'm talking about were countrymen. One of them, poor boy, was very tall, over 6 foot, about 6 foot two, gangling boy, never been away from his home village, and never seemed, in my opinion, never should have been an infantryman. He couldn't do anything properly. When I say properly, I mean in a military manner. He seemed as though he was a misfit. And, of course, he was killed early on.
Do any stand out in your memory, names and personality?
Not now. I was in so many units. I'm sorry, apart from Makepeace as my sergeant, I can't remember.
So you're training very hard and becoming more and more mobile and getting your equipment together. What we haven't mentioned yet is leave. Did you get leave from Chipping Norton?
The first leave I had was one which, in actual fact, extended until I took the troops out as reinforcements in March. I went in at Christmas, and when I got at the end of my leave, I got an instruction that I was to report to the depot. So and Jasper rode with me. So I reported to the depot, and the very next week, Jasper Rudd was posted to the 2nd Battalion, who apparently had lost a few officers through sickness, various other things, and so he went posted to the 2nd Battalion, who were in France then and had been for some time. I was given the job of training under a Colonel Ware, Richard Ware, who was at the depot. He wasn't commanding the depot. The depot was commanded, as I've said in those notes, by Colonel Hasted, but Richard Ware was there waiting a posting, and I was training troops to form reinforcements under him, the sort of training we'd been doing down at Chipping Norton, but in the area of Brownsmith, Meadowfield, and places like that. And I was billeted, in fact, in Meadowfield for a short while, until such time as they were sufficiently trained to be sent overseas.
And these were trained as, in effect, reinforcing drafts?
Reinforcements.
For the other battalions?
For the battalions that were overseas, yes.
Before we go further ahead with your story in the future, Mr. Armstrong, were you getting regular mail in Chipping Norton?
Oh, yes. The mail during the war worked whilst in England just as it does now. It was efficient. It was delivered to battalion headquarters, and then there was a corporal in charge of the mail who used to come round delivering it to the various companies and then platoons. And we had to be careful. Censorship started straight away because of the fact that there was little one could say, but there were things, there were people that were mentioned that could have been of some use to someone, and therefore censorship had to start from the beginning. The men got used to it. I don't think I ever did. It's not a very nice thing to read things and to know that you can't do anything about it, whatever you'd like to do, because you've read it in confidence. But one thing did happen, I'll never forget. One letter came to me to be censored, and I opened it and it said on, "Don't write no more." And I sent for this soldier, who I knew was married, and I said, "What is this about?" And he said, "Well, she's going about with chaps, and she's doing this, and she's doing that, and all she writes to me for is money." And he said, "I want nothing more to do with her." I said, "Unfortunately, you are married. You have children. You are responsible." He said, "She gets the allowance, and I don't want to hear from her anymore." And nothing would persuade him otherwise. Apart from that, if there was something which was wrong, we used to score it out with a black pencil. They used to say a blue pencil. I used a black one, and said nothing about it. And that was literally all it boiled down to. Later on overseas, of course, it became quite a different matter.
Officers' mail, were you put on trust?
Yes.
To mention?
Yes.
There was no censorship of your own higher up?
None. I suppose it was possible that letters were opened somewhere or other, but we never heard of anything, and we had no problems there. You were put on your honour, and that was the end of it. You must remember, we thought very highly of our commission, which had been given to us by His Majesty, and it meant a lot.
Considerable responsibility, though, censorship.
Yes, it was. It was one of the necessary duties you don't like to do. The other thing that I didn't like in the war was sitting in court on a court martial. But censorship was, I feel, still a necessary evil.